Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. They were at one time great friends, then they became bitter enemies. The arc of the friendship of Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft traces an important chapter in American history, and esteemed historian Doris Kearns Goodwin has chronicled it in her latest bestseller, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Doris Kearns Goodwin is the author of a batch of bestsellers, including Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, that became the basis for the Steven Spielberg film. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her book, No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II. She's also written about Lyndon Johnson, the Kennedys, and the game of baseball. Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. And Doris, it's so good to have you with us again. Good morning.
Oh, thank you, Steve. I'm delighted to be back. Absolutely.
Well, the last time I looked, your book was number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list. I'm just wondering, how surprised are you that a book about a pair of presidents from 100 years ago is suddenly a very hot seller?
Oh, well, it's just a delightful thing to know that people really do believe that if you look at the struggles and triumphs of people who lived before, this is what I live for as an historian, that there is something you can take away from that to help you in your own lives or in the lives of our country. And I think there is that refreshing sense that people do like to read history, even sometimes fat books of history, because I never write skinny books. So
you
do have
not.
To know it's going to take a while.
Were you worried when you set out on this book that would people buy a book about something 100 years ago, or do you not worry so much about that anymore?
I think the most important thing I think about before I start a book is it's going to take me so long to write it that I have to figure who do I want to live with over that period of time. It took me 10 years to write Abraham Lincoln, 7 years now to write Teddy and Taft. And the most important thing is the selling of the book is great, and that may take up, you know, 3 or 4 weeks or 5 weeks or 6 weeks of your life. But the living with the guy is the more important thing. And I really always have been fascinated by Teddy Roosevelt. And Taft just came along as I got into the whole thing and expanded my cast of characters. But you have to just decide that those years of research and writing are a much bigger part of your life. And if you love the story of it, you got to just hope people will follow that passion.
You know, in describing this era early in the 1900s, you said there are but a handful of times in the country's history when there occurs a transformation so remarkable that a molt seems to take place and an altered country begins to emerge. And you say the turn of the 20th century was just such a time. How so?
Well, what had happened is between the Civil War and the turn of the 20th century was the Great Industrial Revolution, of course, which did great things for the economy, but also left a public divided between rich and poor in a way that it hadn't been before. Before, most people lived on farms, so the richest person might have been a doctor on the top of a hill, but now they've moved in massive numbers to cities. You've got the immigrants coming into the cities, the tenements, and side by side, these millionaires who've gotten their money from building up what they called then trusts, which are now considered monopolies, so that there was a sense that the middle class was being squeezed by what was happening then. And a lot of potential violent strikes were going on. It was a really turbulent era. And the progressive movement that Teddy Roosevelt is part of is really the answer to that, saying that government has to take a hand in softening the terrible aspects of industrialization. It's not just a good thing, as people thought it was, that the economy is prospering, but people are not prospering equally by it.
You know, you wind up saying and concluding here, Doris, that Teddy Roosevelt is among our greatest presidents, even though he never had to face down, you know, some sort of major national crisis. So why is this man considered to be so special in our national history? Why is he in Mount Rushmore?
I think there's probably two reasons. I mean, it is true that I think normally when you think about Washington, Lincoln, or FDR, the reason that big depressions or wars mobilize the country, so it makes it possible for a president to be remembered by history because he's had to deal with a huge crisis. And most of the other presidents who haven't don't usually get that ranking. What happened with Theodore Roosevelt is he understood the hidden dangers in his era, and he took preventive action. Socialism was pretty strong around the turn of the 20th century, and as I said, the labor strikes had gotten quite violent, and he understood that unless his Republican Party, his own Republican Party, started to take action, which they didn't want to take, the old guard in the Congress, to soften some of these aspects by passing regulatory legislation and cleaning up the fact that there were unhealthy drugs on the market, the meatpacking plants were unsanitary, workers had no compensation, that the Republican Party would lose, and in fact the country might be divided in a class situation. So by taking that action, he really becomes one of those people at the top rank of the presidency. Also, he just, at the time he was president, was one of the most colorful, interesting, nervously manic person that people had ever known. So he became really popular. He became intimate with the country. They loved calling him Teddy. You know, that was his name. And that meant they felt he was their friend somehow.
Is the teddy bear really named after Theodore Roosevelt?
Absolutely. What happened is he went on a bear hunt. Amazing to contemplate today that you could go on a bear hunt for 3 weeks, right, in the middle of the woods. And he didn't get a bear. So the organizers felt guilty that he hadn't gotten a bear. So they brought a bear, put it next to a tree for him to shoot. And he luckily denied shooting the bear. But then the cartoonists made fun of it. And after a while, the bear in the cartoons got smaller and smaller and smaller, and Teddy got bigger and bigger, refusing. And then toy store owners decided, this is something. We'll have teddy bears. And it became, of course, one of the most popular toys of all time.
And they're still selling today, right?
Yeah. They're still selling today. In fact, somebody just gave me a couple teddy bears knowing that the book had come out.
I bet you have a bunch of those, Doris. We're visiting with esteemed historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about her latest book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. And just a reminder, you can see and hear Doris Kearns Goodwin at 7 o'clock Friday, December 13th. That's a week from tomorrow at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You can call Rainy Day Books in Fairway to grab a ticket and the book. That number, 913-384-3126. And Doris will be in a great mood that night, because if I'm reading her schedule right, that will be the last stop before Christmas on this book, if I'm seeing it right, Doris.
You are right. Home the next day.
Yeah, it's not a
so
bad
this
thing.
Will be a great finale.
You know, there's a significant local tie to this man, Theodore Roosevelt, and a connection with our current president, because just even yesterday, they're both talking about some of the same issues, this disparity, the wealth gap between the rich and the middle class and the poor. In 1910, just a little more than a year removed from the White House, Theodore Roosevelt struck out for, of all places, Kansas and a little town named Osawatomie, Kansas, to deliver what's been described as one of the top four or five speeches in the history of this country. Roosevelt gave what's called his new nationalism speech, in which he directly addressed disparities between the rich and the poor. President Obama came to the same town 2 years ago. I covered it for the newspaper here to endorse many of Roosevelt's ideas. Doris, tell us a little more about what Roosevelt was talking about in those days and why there's such a connection to what Barack Obama is talking about today.
Well, I think one of the reasons it was so important to Roosevelt to address the gap between the rich and the poor, it wasn't simply the gap. It was the fact that mobility is one of the things that America's always prided itself on, that it doesn't matter if you're born poor. As long as you work hard and persevere, you can get up through the system and become successful. And that was happening less and less at the turn of the 20th century because of these giant corporations that had been formed and because people had left the farms for the cities, which was a much tougher place to make that breakthrough. And I think what's happened in our modern era is the technological revolution has done similar things for the country, so that you've had this huge billionaires now side by side with a struggling middle class. Unions were just beginning to be strong during Roosevelt's time, and that helped eventually, but they were still under a lot of duress, and unions have diminished in power now in today's world. And so you've got that similar impulse, and I think it is true that Barack Obama is not simply worried about the gap, but we see now new studies that show if you're born poor, the chances of getting out of that bottom quintile are less and less than they were even 50 years ago. And that's a troubling thing for a country that prides itself on the idea of mobility as a central belief in our system.
You know, he's calling this the defining issue of our times. And I'm wondering how you would sort of assess his prospects for actually beginning to change the paradigm here, which is won't be a simple thing to do. This is a very big deal.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, when I think about it, one of the things that happened right after World War II was that during World War II, there had been a pyramidal structure before World War II as well. I mean, even despite Roosevelt and the Progressive Era, the 1920s was obviously another time when the rich got richer and the poor didn't catch up. But then when the New Deal occurred, and then more importantly, World War II and full employment, unions got stronger, government stepped in with an equalized kind of tax, there were different kinds of social programs, and you had a giant middle class that emerged from World War II, really lasting for 25 or 30 years. This problem has been going on now for the last 20, 25 years, so it's really hard to attack. And the problem for, I think, the president right now is that it's, I don't know what he can do about the strength of unions. That's something that's made it happen the way it is now.
Yeah.
And government itself hasn't got the same belief in it that it did. Teddy Roosevelt had to create the belief against a laissez-faire religious conviction that government had a role in softening these problems.
Yeah, people back in those days didn't believe government had that kind of role, right? This was a new kind of a new thinking that he ushered in back then.
And that's what he had to educate the country. That's why he defined the bully pulpit. He's the first person to use the words as the place that a president has with a platform where he can educate the country as to right and wrong. And he used it brilliantly by going around the country on these train trips and using shorthand language to talk about the square deal. And indeed, I think President Obama has taken some of that same centrist idea that it's the square deal, it's fair for rich and poor, for the wage worker and the capitalist, but we have to deal with these problems. But now he's facing a generation that no longer believes the same in government as it did once, and he has to restore some of that belief. And so it's a much many-faceted problem for him, and maybe even harder than it was for Teddy Roosevelt.
And so how did Teddy Roosevelt use the bully pulpit? I mean, how aggressive was he about, you know, making stop after stop around the country? And, you know, you're talking to a talk show host here in the heartland, and we all remember Harry Truman's barnstorming in 1948 that gave him that huge upset win that year. Pretty similar to that, Doris?
No, absolutely. And before Teddy Roosevelt, presidents hadn't traveled as much as he did. But he would get on that train and he would go, you know, out west, especially the west, your part of the country, is where a lot of the fervent was really, the beliefs were beginning to be strengthened and populism was strong. They felt the need of doing something. And so he kept, and that was where his base lay in a certain sense, rather than the eastern aristocratic world from which he came. So he made sure to go out for weeks and weeks on end. And he would not only meet with people at the village stations and give his speeches, but then he would stay in the train and he'd wave to people along the way who were at little road crossings. There's this one wonderful moment when he said he was waving at a group of people and they were so unresponsive, and he finally realized he was frantically waving at a herd of cows. but it showed that he understood that the emotional connection with the people. He said he knew that when he talked, his Harvard buddies thought he might be talking in homely, folksy language. You know, like he'd say, there's no law that can make a coward brave or a fool wise. Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of sayings, people loved them. They were just sort of ordinary, that, you know, the best public servant is like a good friend who never promises something he can't deliver and keeps his word. And people just ate up that sort of centrist philosophy that he had, but he needed to keep doing it. And he needed, most importantly, to create the most unusual relationship with the press that I think any president had, because he knew they could reach the people in a way at the same time that he couldn't always.
And we'll talk in a little bit just about how assiduously President Roosevelt worked the media. We haven't seen that since. Now, this is no comparison at all, but I remember in 2004 when John Kerry, then the Democratic presidential nominee, took a train trip across Missouri, and I was on the train for that thing. Boy, there is really something, you just want to embrace it, because, you know, at 10 o'clock at night, the train would make these unscheduled stops in these little burgs, and there would be hundreds of people who would come out to see the Democratic presidential nominee. I can only begin to imagine what the reaction was back in the early 1900s for someone as vigorous as Teddy Roosevelt.
No, you're right. And in fact, the trains itself were part of the magic. I mean, Teddy admitted, he said, that sometime it was like people seeing the steamships for the first time. They were seeing a Pullman train for the first time. Yeah. So he knew that was part of the attraction, not just him. But I still think there's something about a train. I mean, James Reston, the reporter, once said in covering campaigns, he used to be on the train, actually, like with Harry Truman, and then they're in airplanes instead. He said, the higher we flew, the less we knew, because there was a real camaraderie of the reporters and the people on the train. And then Teddy would invite people from one city to the other to travel with him from one place to another. And right, as you say, on those little road crossings, the excitement of seeing a president. And there's a sense that he gets of the public sentiment in the country by doing that, that you can never get by staying in Washington and flying from one place to another and going to a fundraising dinner or something like that.
Yeah. Well, there's excitement the president feels. There's excitement a talk show host by having someone like Doris Kearns Goodwin on the air, the great historian. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. She's written books far-reaching past Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, books on Lincoln. She once worked for LBJ. Lots of presidential history here. Again, 816-235-2888, or email us UpToDate at kcur.org, or you can tweet us at kcurUpToDate. Doris, let's turn to Teddy Roosevelt's good friend, and this was no ordinary friendship. This one involving William Howard Taft. This is the same William Howard Taft that Roosevelt would run against and then seek to deny a second term to back in 1912. But years earlier, Taft was Roosevelt's chief surrogate during the 1904 presidential race. Taft served as Roosevelt's acting president when Roosevelt was away, and it was Taft that Roosevelt endorsed to succeed him in 1908. Why were they so close? What was it?
Well, they had first met when they were in their 1930s, when they were in their 30s, rather, and Taft was Solicitor General and Teddy was Civil Service Commissioner. And they were both at that time what they might call young reformers. They were against the corruption of the age, against even people in their own party who were sustaining that tie between business and the political bosses. So they felt like they were comrades. But I think even more than that, they were almost like opposites attracting.
Yeah.
I mean, Teddy said of Taft that he envied Taft's personality because people loved him at first sight. He was so amiable, so gentle, so kind. And Taft said of Teddy that he envied his rhetorical ability and his fighting spirit, which he didn't have. He was much more of a judicial temperament.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, physically, they're miles apart. I mean, Teddy's this physically manic, exercising guy, fit, the strenuous image. And Taft, even from the time he was a child, was overweight.
From the time he was born, he comes out and he's a big boy, right? And
I know. It's really – I mean, I shouldn't be – smiling at it, but it was just so funny to read the mother's letters when he was born that there wasn't enough milk for him. She had to get a surrogate milker. And then by years one, he couldn't fit into his little dresses. They couldn't have belts on them. But the interesting thing is at that time, and we're talking about the late 1850s, to be a fat, ravenous kid was a good thing because she had lost her first child at 14 months who was too frail. So there wasn't that same recognition then, I think, of the problems of obesity. And actually, by the time he got to Yale, he weighed 250 pounds, which wasn't bad for his weight and build.
But in the White House, he would balloon up to 350, I think, right?
And I think that's partly because he was anxious. I mean, what happened is, as great as he was as the number two person for Teddy, and you're right, he was the acting president when Teddy went away. Somebody said to Roosevelt, what's going to happen while you're gone all this time? He said, oh, don't worry, Taft is sitting on the lid. And then, of course, cartoons were spawned, you know, with this big Taft sitting on the lid of domestic problems. And he was the surrogate. Presidents didn't campaign on their own behalf in those days. So Taft was the one who went out to make the case for Teddy's reelection or election in 1904. And so I hadn't realized that not only had Teddy handpicked him, but ran the campaign.
I didn't
told
know
him
that
stop playing golf because it was a rich man's game and the working class didn't like it. Stop your pictures there. And he's constantly giving him advice. The only thing I think he didn't advise him on was Taft had this crazy campaign song, which was "Get on a raft with Taft." If you got on a raft with 350-pound Taft, you wouldn't be on it very long. But so not knowing how close they'd been, I didn't know until I got into this story how emotionally heartrending it was when they broke apart in 1912.
Well, and we'll talk about that, too. You know, the service you're providing here is that when most Americans, if they have any image whatsoever of William Howard Taft, all they see in their minds is a very heavyset man. And there's so much more to this guy than just that, obviously.
No, I really felt a great deal of respect and empathy and liking for him. I mean, he may not have been suited to be president and be in the public spotlight, but at every other stage in his career, he really performed admirably, and people had great respect for him, and we should too as a people, and not just categorize him as this one fat guy.
He would go on to become the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, which was the job he really sort of always wanted, right?
Yeah, it shows how temperament is so important in politics. I mean, Teddy, from the time he was just out of college, joined the state legislature, was elected, loved politics, really never wanted to be away from it his whole life. And Taft, from the time he was Teddy's age, right after college, wanted to be a judge. And it's a very different temperament. If you're a judge, as Taft later said, he realizes he didn't use the bully pulpit the way he should have because he thought when you make a decision, it just explains itself. Yeah. And he didn't like talking to reporters, like which Teddy adored, because he thought that you're not supposed to as a judge. And he liked to have time to make his decisions. He was somewhat of a procrastinator. And in the presidency, you got to make decisions much more quickly than you might as a judge. So one temperament was perfectly suited for public life. The other one was perfectly suited for judicial life. And luckily, as you said, Taft finally got his dream the last decade of his life. And when he became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he said it was the happiest day of his life.
Hmm. Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest. Our phone number again, 816-235-2888. Lots of phone calls for her. That's not a big surprise. Brian from Raytown. Brian, good morning. You're on Up to Date.
Yeah, I wondered what your assessment is of the influence of William Jennings Bryan on the same time period.
It's huge. I mean, there's no question that William Jennings Bryan and the populists were the first to really speak up in the 1890s, before the progressive movement, before Teddy Roosevelt, about the inequities of the age, about the problems that the farmers were facing versus the city, about the tariff. And then at the time, however, McKinley was able to best him in those elections. But it didn't mean that that stream of protest hadn't developed. And in some ways, Teddy picks up that populist stream and makes it more middle class and makes it less scary, as it might have seemed under William Jennings Bryan. But there's no question that not only him, but the Populist Party set the stage for the progressive movement. So they deserve a lot of the credit for what eventually came into being in terms of the legislation that helped the people during that difficult era.
Thank you.
Brian, thank you for the call. Let's go to Jim from Kansas City, Missouri. Jim, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Jim.
I wanted to tell you that I first learned about bully pulpit on your show more than a year ago. And I immediately tried to order it, not realizing that it was a year off. So I've been waiting a long
That's because
time.
I was very late.
Well, it's well worth the wait. And the comments just a moment ago about Taft were particularly interesting to me because it is a person that we don't know as much about as we do Teddy, and I'm loving the book. But I wanted, if I might, ask a question about another of your books, one of my favorites, and I have a special reason for asking about it, but it's Wait Till Next Year.
Oh, and it was a great joy for me to do it.
Well, it comes through, and on the surface, it's about your great love of baseball.
Right,
and the
baseball book.
Fan rivalry in your neighborhood. But on another level, it is really about the sense of community that those of us who grew up in that time remember in our neighborhoods. And I'm afraid a lot of that's been lost. And I have even used your book as a reference for when I'm trying to train neighborhood leaders to give the younger people some sense of what community was at that time. And where you relied on it. It was your primary support system. And I just thought that was, it just evoked so many wonderful memories for me. And I just wanted to kind of get some affirmation from you on that because I know you love baseball and that was fun to read that, but it's the community part that just really grabbed me.
No, for me too, actually. I mean, when I look back on that era, I don't think it's just nostalgia. I mean, sometimes when you look back on your childhood, you're not remembering. And there were tough times. There was the McCarthy era. There was the Cold War. There was the fear of the atomic bomb. But there was that sustaining sense of being a kid living on a block where you could play all day outside with your friends. There were so many kids my age on that block. You could ride your bike and just leave the kickstand and not have a lock. We never locked our doors in our houses.
Yeah.
And the people did support one another. And that's much harder in the modern time. So I think remembering that fondly is a real memory, not just a nostalgic one.
Oh, Doris, you're just all high and mighty this year because of the Red Sox. And they won again. And you're feeling good. And you were there
at game six.
Game.
Of course I was.
Yeah, well, I hope you enjoyed it because I think next year, I can say this for the first time in 20 years, maybe the Royals are going to be there knocking at the door a little bit. So
I will gladly welcome them. We may not be back again. So we've had our happiness. But
I'd be glad
to be there again. It was the best year.
Bill from Stillwell, you're on with Doris Kearns Goodwin. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure and an honor to speak with Doris. I have a couple of your books. I love your book on Lincoln. is amazing.
Thank you.
I had a question about the movie. I watched the movie twice, then read the book, and then went back, watched the movie twice again on DVD. I'm a detailed person. The question is, when you watch, a couple questions and a comment. When you watch the movie, do you wish that more of the book was covered in the movie, either with some mini vignettes in the beginning, because, for example, you talk about why Lincoln was successful compared to the anointed ones, right? You talk about the senator from New York, and, you know, he's supposed to become the next president. He's got all the money, but here's Lincoln, this little farm boy, this country lawyer, and because he owned a bar in Springfield, and he learned to tell stories from his father, that he was able to connect with the people, which is exactly what you were just talking about with Roosevelt.
Right. Let me, Bill, let me have her talk about, do you wish more the movie was covered? Doris, do you wish more the movie was there?
No, you know, it's a really good question. I mean, and when Tony Kushner began the script, it was a much longer movie, and it covered much more period of time, but it was like 700 pages, so it would never have been able to be a movie.
Yeah.
So when they finally just cut it down, and I talked to them through that whole process, what mattered to me more than the story that it covered, whether it was 1860 to 1865 or just as it ended up, 1865, did they capture the Lincoln that I thought I knew from living with him? And I think they absolutely did. I mean, they got him as a, you know, as a guy who told stories to whistle away his sadness, a guy who was politically incredibly smart, smarter than the people at the time knew he was, and yet principled.
Yes. Yeah.
And all of that, he came alive. When I first saw the first cut of the movie at Spielberg's house, long before it came out, I just thought I was watching the Lincoln that I knew in Daniel Day-Lewis.
Wow.
And that's what mattered to me more than anything. He was walking like I knew he walked, like a farmer coming home at the end of the day. He was talking in that high-pitched voice, which we knew from a memoir that he talked in. I thought it was spectacular.
Bill, I have time for one more question from you.
So let's connect it to Kennedy now. Both presidents got assassinated. So my question, I've been watching a lot of Kennedy, the one about on HBO that was released back in the late 80s, in his own words. And when I watched that and I look at the book and I read the book, I watch the movie and I read the book, I get a sense, and I'm sorry to offend people here, I'm an independent, registered independent in Kansas, but I cannot get the sense that Kennedy is way overplayed in our society. And when I see him, I see more pictures of Vogue magazine versus, you know, really, I mean, if you compare any president to Lincoln, you get a sense that, God, if this guy was not there, there would be no America today. There would be two Americas.
What about that,
Doris?
There's
no question that Lincoln will always be, I would think, among the top, if not the top president in our country's history, not just because of the Civil War, but because of his person and his leadership.
Yeah.
And I think that John F. Kennedy, you're right, in popular culture, he still remains so strong because of those images of him, the way he was killed, the youthfulness, the inspiration of the decade that he started. But the truth was he had only 3 years as president, and not that much could be accomplished in those 3 years. I mean, some was. But I remember my husband worked for John Kennedy, and he one time was talking after Kennedy's death with Bobby, who was lamenting that he wouldn't be remembered as a great president because he only had the 3 years. So my husband, trying to make him feel better, said, oh, don't worry, Julius Caesar only had 3 years. And then Kennedy said, yeah, but it helps to have Shakespeare write about you.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our great conversation here with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. We'll talk more about the golden age of journalism. We'll talk about this massive falling out between William Howard Taft and Teddy Roosevelt. And your phone calls to 816-235-2888. Again, you can see Doris Kearns Goodwin a week from Friday, December 13th at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books and Fairway to grab a ticket. It'll be crowded that night, 913-384-3126. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Join our DVD gurus and me for a special screening of the classic film All the President's Men. This will be this coming Sunday at 2 in the afternoon at the Alamo Drafthouse. Tickets are only $7, and not only do you get a chance to see a great film, but you'll also get to hear our resident film experts talk and me about that movie as well. If you're looking to score some free ticks, just visit KCUR Facebook page for more information. Again, come out on Sunday afternoon at 2 to see all the president's men at the Alamo Draft House downtown. Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, who's featured in that film as played by Robert Redford, was just in town. I had a chance to talk to him about that film. Again, our guest this hour is Doris Kearns Goodwin. We're talking about her new book, her new bestseller, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Doris, let's turn to this notion of how quickly the two of them fell out once Taft became president. Teddy Roosevelt is off in Africa. He's on an expedition. And then he comes home, and your book begins with his homecoming to New York. And this is something we don't see today, this kind of homecoming, this raucous reception given for a returning hero like Theodore Roosevelt. Describe that homecoming for us.
Yeah, and what happened is he had, of course, been on his safari in Africa. Then he went through Europe, where he was lionized by kings and queens. So for America, still a young power in the world, it was pretty thrilling for them to read about the reception that Teddy got in Europe itself. And then he comes home, and a million people are waiting for him in New York when he disembarked.
Yeah.
And everywhere there were signs on every building, welcome home Teddy, teddy bears hanging everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think what happened is, in part, he had already begun to hear from his progressive friends that Taft had been more conservative than he had hoped he would be. But I think also that desire to get into politics again began to grow that very day.
Just cough for a second, and I'll just give you a
second
here.
I'm back.
Yeah, you're back there. Yeah, I heard you drifting away there.
Thank you,
yeah.
Sir.
Yeah. Go ahead. And so he comes back.
So I think what happened, he comes home that day, and suddenly he sees and feels that extraordinary relationship with the people that he'd had during his presidency. And I think it begins to create, oh, my God, I've missed this. And so that's a strand that's going along there. But then there's also his progressive friends. A rupture had occurred between the two sides of the party. It would have been there even if Teddy had been there, because the people in the West were feeling they weren't treated right about the tariff. They wanted lower tariffs. The people in the East wanted to keep high tariffs. It was like the tax battle would be today. And Taft bravely tries to create a Tariff Reform Act while Teddy's in Africa, and he compromises too much, so the progressives feel, with the old guard in the Congress. And the rupture had gotten so big that even dealing with that old guard and having his picture taken with them was seen as a sign of betrayal. He gets a tariff reform bill through. It's a little better than what they had, but it's not enough. And it begins to make a rift between Taft and the progressives. So the progressives go to Teddy and say, you know, your friend has betrayed you. We need you. We need you to stand on our banner. And eventually he decides to run against Taft for the nomination in 1912, and it's disastrous for both of them.
I'm just wondering, so when Taft gets word that Roosevelt suddenly is talking about how much he misses the White House and hinting that he might go again, how does that news hit his old buddy?
It really hurt Taft. I mean, and we know it because, luckily for historians, there was a military aide to Teddy named Archie Butt, who Teddy adored, actually. And a military aide in those days would be with the president much of the day. He thought of him as another son, loved him more than anyone outside his family, according to one of the family members. And he stayed on with Taft. And at the time he stayed on, Teddy was still friendly. It looked great. And he became really close to Taft, too. And he wrote then letters to his family every day. And the letters really reveal the emotional hurt that Taft was feeling. At first, he didn't understand it. He thought it may have had to do that a letter didn't reach Teddy that he had sent him. I mean, he thought of all sorts of little things that might have happened. Mm. His wife, Nellie, had had a devastating stroke a month after his presidency. And as a result, they didn't have the same social functions in the White House.
A month after his inauguration, and she was key to him, and she really was his sounding board and someone he could rely on for solid advice, and that was missing for him then.
No, I think in some ways it may have altered his entire presidency. I mean, here was this woman who'd always loved politics from the time she was a young girl. Back in Cincinnati, she used to go to the raucous beer halls so she could talk politics with laborers and working people. She wanted to be something in her own right, thought she'd never get married so that she could have her own career. She was a teacher until she met Will Taft, who promised her that she would be his partner, and she was. And she's the one who loved politics more than him the whole time, spurred him onward. He said he would have been a judge in Cincinnati had it not been for Nellie. Really smart, really creative woman. And her first few months in the presidency, she was the most activist first lady we'd seen. She not only brought the cherry trees to Washington, but she created a public park for people and free concerts. She worked on working girl issues. The New York Times wrote about her being an extraordinary person. The very next day after they wrote, she was on a yacht with the president, and she fell, and it turned out she'd had a stroke, that she finally got to walk again but could never speak in connected sentences again. And he spent hours with her trying to teach her to say, "Glad you're here. I'm happy to see you," so she could still be part of the receptions. But as a result, she didn't have many social functions in the White House, and Edith Roosevelt felt that she had been shunned and her children had been shunned, and that created part of the crazy dispute between the two men, but then politics took over.
You know, so all this happens, so much turmoil. Your book goes far beyond this story. It gets into this golden age of journalism, which is part of your title here. Why was this the golden age of journalism? What was happening in the country then that made journalism so important?
Well, what happened is that when they first started talking about the trusts or the monopolies, as Teddy himself recognized, it was an abstract issue. People didn't understand what had happened. And there was this magazine. When I first started reading books about the Progressive Era, all the great historians would say there was this one magazine, McClure's Magazine, which was as important to the Progressive Era as Teddy Roosevelt was. So I said, oh, my God, I better figure this out. And I knew some of the people in it, Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens, but there was also Ray Baker and Kansas's William Allen White.
You're taking the next question out of my mouth here. Yeah.
And so they were comrades in this magazine. McClure, this extraordinarily interesting founder, gave them 2 years if they wanted to do the research of investigation so that before they started writing their big series, it would be fact-based, really impregnable. Ida Tarbell writes about how Standard Oil was formed by unfair illegal means, changes forever the reputation of John D. Rockefeller. And Ray Baker writes about railroads, and Lincoln Steffens about corruption in the cities, and William Allen White is constantly writing about politics. And they had such an impact on the country that it pressured the people in the Congress who didn't want any of this legislation to pass to have to bring it to the floor, and then it did pass. So they were in league with Teddy Roosevelt, I think, and being the vanguards of the progressive movement.
You know, it's almost hard for a guy like me who has covered politics in the 80s, 90s, and, you know, in this century when, you know, people didn't pay as much attention. It's really amazing for me to read about folks like Kansas's own William Allen White and the influence they had, the ability to get close to somebody like Teddy Roosevelt. Tell us a little more about William Allen White and this relationship he had with Teddy, because he even aimed to get Roosevelt into the White House in the election of 1904, figuring that McKinley would serve out his entire term, of course. And in fact, White would write of Roosevelt more than 25 years after his death, and I just love this line, that he had never known a man like Theodore Roosevelt, and he would never know one like him again. I mean, what a line.
No, in fact, William Allen White is an extraordinary character. I mean, here he is, this country editor in Emporia, Kansas, and yet he's more quoted than almost any other editor in the country because he writes so many articles, he writes books, and he spoke like Teddy Roosevelt did in a very folksy manner that people adored. And he came to Washington in the 1890s, and he met Theodore Roosevelt for the first time. And he had been conservative. He grew up in a wealthy family. A father was a doctor. He thought the populists were all wrong. And he came and met Teddy, and Teddy just suddenly was the trumpet call of the next decades, and he became a progressive himself. And unlike the other writers in McClure's, he was actually a political operative as well. I mean, they stayed much more as reporters, but he was active in Kansas politics. And Teddy and he became as close friends as they could possibly be. They wrote, I think there's like 1,000 letters between these two men.
Yeah.
I really liked William Allen White. It was fun, too. And I can't wait someday to go to Emporia so I can see his little town.
It's so cool to see. And at one point, Teddy Roosevelt writes to William Allen White early on saying, "Hey, I'll be coming through Kansas. Can you get on the train? I want to visit with you for a few hours and get your counsel on this issue and that issue." It was that kind of relationship.
And what was healthy about it was that they could criticize. They read each other's writings. Teddy wrote the short stories that William Allen White wrote. And William Allen White could criticize Teddy. One time he writes him a letter saying that your sentences have become too long. I don't know what's happened to you. I counted one that was 27 lines long.
He
said, you should look back at Lincoln's writings and see that he had short sentences. And Teddy writes back saying something like, "Lincoln was a genius. I'm just slaving to do good work."
Well, it is interesting the extent to which Theodore Roosevelt, he does gush over William Allen White. I mean, he's clearly cultivating the relationship in addition to, you know, gleaning some great insights from William Allen White.
Now, he knew that white had, you know, a lot of influence in the West, and the West really was what he needed. I mean, the one thing that made, I think, Roosevelt such a popular president was that even though he came from the East, came from a wealthy background, and went to a place like Harvard, he knew how to talk to the Western farmers. He knew mm-hmm. how to talk to them in their own language. And I think White helped him with that. You know, White knew all the people in the West. He had been a political operative for a while. So it was a really intense friendship. There's no question about it.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest. Just for a few more moments, let's go back to some phone calls here, and let's go to Rick from Overland Park. Rick, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's such a pleasure to get to talk to your guest.
Absolutely.
I'm just in the book now, and this is my first book of yours, Doris, but I'm a big Teddy Roosevelt fan. I read Wilderness Warrior by Douglas Brinkley and learned so
much
from that.
That's a wonderful book.
Oh, my gosh. I learned so much from that about his advocacy and almost establishing the concept of public land. And so I'm so glad that you wrote this book. And my question is, I've already learned a lot about, you know, their relationship, and I had no idea anything about Taft, but the fact that Roosevelt loved him so much speaks so highly of him. But there's a passage, I think, at the end of Chapter 9, I don't have the book in front of me, that Roosevelt, I think in a letter perhaps to Taft, is writing, and he writes a statement somewhere along the lines of he shudders to think of himself possibly in the future, or he shudders to think of this happening to him and what he sees happens to other politicians, becoming ghosts of their former selves, trying to reclaim
what
they once
had.
And it just struck me when I read that as such foreshadowing that kind of did happen to him, that early in his term, he said he wouldn't run again, and then, you know, he had such regret that he came back and ran against his friend and trying to reclaim that lost mantle. I just wondered if when you put that in there, if that was... that resonated, and that's what your analysis of it.
Yeah, great call, Rick.
You know, you're so right. I'm so glad you reminded me. What's scary about these books, when they take me so long, I forget some of the things that I was writing them 3 or 4 years ago. But that's a really important line. I think that's right. He had this image in his mind of being a politician who no longer was in the center of action and that was trying to cling on, and he hated that thought. You're absolutely right, shuddered at that thought. And unfortunately, that is what happened to him, I think. I think he couldn't... First of all, he's so young. I mean, that's the problem. He's, you know, he could have had that third term had he wanted to, but he made that pledge in 1904 that he would have had 7 years, essentially, after McKinley's assassination. So it was two terms. He later said he would have cut off his wrist to have not made that statement or cut out his tongue. And he craved being president. He loved it. And so nothing else could quite fill the sense of exercising his talents and being in a place that he wanted to. And so he did try to come back in 1912. If he had waited until 1916, he probably could have won. And then the whole history of the country might have been different.
Yeah.
But I think that need was too great inside of him.
Doris, just very quickly, the DreamWorks studio has picked up the rights to this book for a potential future film. Who should play Teddy Roosevelt, and how about William Howard Taft?
Well, I keep teasing who's become my friend now, Daniel Day-Lewis. If we could only gain 100 pounds, he could be Teddy. 150 or 200, he could be Taft. Everybody says John Goodman for Taft and,
there you go.
You know, Philip Seymour Hoffman possibly for Teddy, but I will leave that up to Stephen. He's a better man at knowing that. He brilliantly picked everybody, I think, for the Lincoln movie.
Yeah.
You know, Sally Field and Tommy Lee Jones were just perfect,
well,
as
Doris,
well as Daniel, of course.
Always great to have you here. Thank you for taking some time with us.
Oh, I thank you for doing this with me. Thank you, Steve.
All the best, Doris. Again, that's Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her latest book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Again, she appears 7 o'clock December 13th, a week from Friday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Rainy Day Books and Fairway to get a ticket. That number, 913-384-3126.